Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour for January 14th, 2018, and many topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about the, they always do this, NASA pulls this off, they always do this just around my showtime on Thursday, they did it last week, this bogus announcement about finding life on Mars. Oh my goodness, I'll talk about that a little bit. I've talked about that on previous shows. Wednesday morning with John Moore's show, I gave a bit of discussion on that. Also on the Power Hour yesterday, I was guest with Daniel Brigman and discussed that topic also. So I'll be covering that. I'll talking about the USS Liberty, the 1967 war with between Israel, where they I'll be talking about the USS Liberty. And then a little bit about geoengineering. By the way, next week, it was going to happen this week, a surprise interview. As you all know, I rarely have guests on my show. I don't take callers on my show because it's, well, many reasons. But I do take emails, and I look through the emails that people send in and comments and questions and et cetera. So that's the way that listeners get to partake in this show. And the reason is a lot of times listeners will call in and have topics which are not germane to what's going on at the time, or they ramble and they're really not professional on the radio. So I have a different way of interacting with the public. I take emails and then I can read them, etc. So a lot of the topics I cover actually come in from listeners asking me to talk about this or that, etc. So I rarely have guests also, but this week I was going to have a guest, but I had all kinds of sound problems. And so anyway, this should occur next week, but a gentleman that I met through various other means, I've never met him in person, but just by telephone, talked quite a bit. His name is Robert Schuller, and he's a graduate, put it this way. He was a student at Cornell University, and he was very advanced in high school and got into Cornell at a younger age, and then while he was sitting there taking a course on GMO methods and of genetically modified organisms, basically GMO, and Monsanto, what he found was that it was like a rah-rah, everything is great, isn't this wonderful type of course, and without any contrary side to it. So he started a personal campaign. He has a webpage. It's called GMOWTF.com, and he's raising money for a video that he's doing. You can go there and look at it. Once again, that's GMOWTF.com, and his point is that I think he'll explain it better there. So just go there, and he's also asking people to help fund. It's a crowdfunding effort where he's going to make a video exposing the issues at Cornell University, how it's bought and paid for by Monsanto, and the research, and how the staff and the students just go along with this like it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But I will believe I'll have him on next week, as long as we can get our sound issues fixed. So stay tuned for that. A quick mention of fusion. Now, fusion I have defined in my work as being the nuclear reaction that's in the atmosphere of the sun, that it shows that the nuclear fusion of the sun is not at the core. It's up in the atmosphere, which leads to a whole different scenario of how the sun works. And this has actually been proven by high-level Russian scientists in the mid-1990s did experiments to prove this. And I talk about this in my weather book. But anyway, let's bring this down to planet Earth where we all live. And you hear many times, oh, if we could only have fusion energy, it would be cheap energy and it would be, well, it'd be inexpensive. So it'd be really good. And then we'd have infinite amount of energy, all the energy we could ever want, and all our problems would be over. Well, that's really wrong. And here's the reason. We have plenty of hydrogen on Earth. I mean, the ocean is, every water molecule contains two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen. So, and of course, oxygen is good because we breathe it. But if you grab the natural sources of hydrogen and burn them, well, first of all, we'd have, I don't know if you could call it deuterium pollution, or would you reburn that or whatever, would depend on the level of expertise that was obtained in, that was garnered in fusion research. But here's the problem. Anytime you take an inert substance, which hydrogen is, it's just by itself, it's a gas. It could be in liquid form attached to water, but H2 is a stable molecule. Anytime you take an inert material and then create heat energy, and this is the case with fusion reactors where they burn, you know, uranium-based fuels, you're taking something that is just sitting there and creating a tremendous amount of heat. And that is the issue. And that's bizarrely one of the things that global climate change people never mentioned, that they're worried about this. Oh, in 20 years, we're going to have a 0.01 change and rise in temperature from an alleged greenhouse effect that doesn't work. But they never talk about the extraordinary, super extraordinary amount of energy that's released minute by minute by the fusion process as it's being burned in the nuclear reactor power plant. So the issue is the same with fusion. It's much cleaner burning. You don't get the radioactivity that you get off of the high mass fusion based nuclear products. But there's another issue with procuring hydrogen. Hydrogen in our atmosphere, etc., is not really abundant in the free form. In fact, it has such a low presence that it's not even listed as a contributor to the composition of Earth's atmosphere. If you went to Jupiter or Saturn, that would be a different story, but we really don't have trains available to go out and harvest hydrogen from those young, small stars out there. Well, not young, but they are small stars, both of them. But the other issue with hydrogen is then if it's not in the atmosphere and readily available, where would it come from? And also, I just mentioned the byproducts are not really usable, but hydrogen would have to be harvested with other energy. So these would be chemical forms of energy or electrical, as in the electrolysis separation of water. So say we set up a system like this, where hydrogen was harvested from the oceans. We took electrolysis, set up electrolysis stations. We used some form of naturally occurring energy, for example, wind or solar, to convert to electricity to run the separation process to get hydrogen out of the water. Then we would have oxygen. And remember that too much oxygen is not good either, although we could probably use a bit more since we use so much in the consumption of automobiles and coal-fired power plants or natural gas-fired power plants, etc., or burning for ships that cross the ocean carrying, transporting, etc. They all burn oxygen. So more oxygen in the atmosphere might be okay, but with everything, there's a limit. You don't want to put too much oxygen into the atmosphere. But no matter how you cut it, it takes energy to get hydrogen into the form where you can now attempt to burn it in a nuclear reactor. And this is the case. In fact, this is one of the unknown or unmentioned energy factors in our energy budget, is the procurement of the fuel. You know, if you have a coal plant or if you had a nuclear plant, whatever, natural gas requires fracking, and the way it's harvested today in quantities. So, of course, coal has to be dug out, transferred by train. So all of the energy used, expended in supporting the, say, the gasoline engine business, all of that has to be taken into account. And likewise for hydrogen that would be used in a fusion reactor. So is fusion the save all for the human race? And the answer is simply no. It's going to take energy, energy that would be taken away from our normal energy usage, just to obtain, isolate the hydrogen. Then you have the heat factor, the fact that heat is generated in the process, and it's no more efficient than burning fusion uranium in the fusion reaction, or burning coal or natural gas or number two fuel oil, or whatever the case may be. But generating heat at the source where you generate the electricity is in and of itself a problem. And that problem, very simply, is what is known as the Carnot cycle, that a large percentage, and then just physical factors, a large percentage of that energy that's burned is going to be wasted. It's going to go directly into the environment as heat. So once again, we come back to the very basic issue of taking an inert substance, which I term a high energy content fuel, so that includes coal, nuclear, as in uranium-based fuels, coal, nuclear, natural gas, number two, fuel oil. Those are the main sources of electrical heat, heat for electrical generating plants. And then throw in fusion of hydrogen. Then also you have the problem of storing the hydrogen. It's highly, highly explosive material. When it mixes with oxygen gives off a tremendous amount of heat. So you're dealing with something that is literally more dangerous to store than, say, for example, natural gas. Of course, we have good storage facilities for natural gas, very safe. But coal, in a sense, is much easier to store. If you have coal, big, big piles of it sitting outside a coal-fired power plant, we don't consider that a danger. But hydrogen creates a whole new sub-industry of how do you store it and contain it and move it and ship it, etc. You see these vast shipping ships that go to, for example, China, is burning more and more natural gas, and it's contained in pressurized vessels. They look just like an oil tanker, except they have big globes that are containing the pressurized natural gas. But the same issue would occur for hydrogen. So all in all, I really get angry when people make these pie-in-the-sky statements like this is the solution to all our problems. Well, if we burned and used more energy in the form of hydrogen, that's not a solution. We're still damaging our environment. The heat issue is something that is a big factor, and nobody talks about it, especially like the global warming people. I just saw, by the way, two articles which indicated, remember, Trump had appointed people to head the agencies and cleaning out the, for example, Environmental Protection Agency of the nutcase, lunatic, fringe, global climate change just that dominated the EPA, and they were not doing their job in any other respect. It was just going into that. Well, the NASA chief that he appointed was also appointed to clear out the baloney and get back to real issues. I just saw an article where he, the head of NASA, has converted back to global climate change, and there's just this big round of applause, like they just won, you know, the World Series championship or the Super Bowl. And also, 2 days ago, he just made an announcement that NASA wants to go to Mars, which is absolutely against the Trump mandate that they have to go back to the moon first. So, you know, this is part of what, you know, if you want to call it the scientific deep state, I guess would be a great term. And believe me, there is a deep state within NASA and NASA ranks, that these people were brought up on global climate change and working on projects that have no end, that really don't produce any real science, or the, you know, dirty snowball comet model. Yeah, NASA is full of deep state idiots that are, you know, pushing in these ridiculous directions that have no merit, but they get their paycheck, and as long as they can keep everybody marching to the same tune, then life is good. The money just keeps rolling in. Okay, so enough of that, but fusion is not the cheap solution that everybody talks about. It's just another bogus piece of incredulous science that comes out of the science industry. Okay, here's something that just hit the streets, and I just about dropped my jaw when I saw this. And let me preface this by saying, when you look at something, let's take the Old West, let's take political figures in the past, let's take governments of the past, let's take science of the past, let's take scientists of the past. You have to look at them in light of the times. You have to look at them in light of the times that they lived in. And it's something that people really have a hard time doing today. They put on their rosy little 2018 political correctness glasses and start viewing the past. And that has to do partly with also all of this, let's remove all the statues in the South of Civil War heroes, claiming that this supports slavery, which it wasn't at all. The Civil War had absolutely nothing to do with slavery. That's a modern construct in the history books that people are taught, and it's totally false. But at any rate, this just came out, and it just blew my mind. Political correctness gone awry again. But anyway, Einstein's memos and his diary have been released. And he's now being called a xenophobe and a racist because he made comments when he went on some of his travels. Now, let me just preface this also by saying, here's a guy who was Jewish and was ostracized for his being Jewish. He had to leave Germany, came to the United States, ends up at Princeton, and all the rest is history. You know, he came to the United States very early in his career, but was instrumental in the Manhattan Project, was instrumental in fundamental physics and quantum physics and so many areas of physics, relativity that he just made up himself. You know, these were his own topics, but the keys that opened the door to a lot of modern physics. But he's being accused with these rosy-colored 2018 politically correct glasses as a xenophobe and a racist, when what he was saying is, when he went to these countries, now remember that Germany was a very advanced country. The people were educated. They were university, a lot of high-level education in the schools, and they had a very structure. If the kids couldn't make it to the university level, they were put into other educational systems that gave them trades, that gave them skills, that made them employable, something that is not done today in the United States. So the rosy-colored, politically correct critics, of course, don't know what it was like in Germany post-World War II. It was a very highly cultured place. Like today, if you went to Switzerland, very similar, that same ethic was there. That work ethic, that cleanliness, that keep yourself clean, keep your house clean, everything in order. There, you know, just almost to the other extreme of meticulous maintenance of their lives and their lifestyles and their clothes and their habits and how they treated people and, you know, their etc. And so to call Einstein a xenophobe and a racist, because when he got to some places where he was traveling, the people were very guttural. They did not bathe, they did not wash, they didn't clean, they pooped in the middle of the street if they wanted to. I'm not kidding you, this is the way it was. And they, you know, hygiene was not, you know, something that was known. There was no work ethic. And he commented on these. And to imagine that he's somehow racist because of these comments. Now, let me take those same rosy-colored, politically correct yahoos of today. I call them big city hicks. What's a big city hick? A big city hick, and I developed this term when I was in college because I met a lot of them. As I was from a small town, and a lot of people would laugh at me, oh, do you still have Indians riding up and down the streets in your town in Minnesota? You know, and it was like, you know, no, I grew up in a very clean environment, and we did not have Indians riding up and down the road, and we were very cultured people, and we would never make fun of somebody else because of their lifestyle or living habits or whatever. And, you know, you can make a comment, but making fun of them is something totally different. And I was taught not to do that. You don't make fun of other people. Although I do make fun of NASA because they duly deserve it. But not directly at people. You know, I make fun of NASA scientists with their skinny little ties and their moronic ideas. Yeah, fair game. They're big shots. Big boys out in the big world, they deserve it. Okay, but to take a pot shot at Einstein, calling him a xenophobe and a racist because he makes comments about the uncleanliness of the people, and let me tell you something. These people that are politically correct, I would like to see them go to a third world country today where there's severe poverty and the things that Einstein was talking about, lack of cleanliness, lack of, and a lot of times it's not because of a fault of the people, it's because they don't have a lot of clean water, they don't have a clean water source, etc. I've been in places, I guarantee you, where 99% of you out there would vomit if you were there because of the living conditions of the people. It's not nice. And so the rosy-colored, you know, politically correct armchair judges of the United States, I would like to see them go, for example, this is a great example. I was talking to some people one time, and they said, oh yeah, this woman is very well-traveled. She's very worldly. She knows a lot about the world, travels to third world countries. And I said, yeah, she stays in a 5-star hotel and doesn't leave in the third world country. She has no clue of what life is like in a third world country. Her view of Mexico is a 5-star resort on the coast of Cancun. That's not Mexico, believe me. It has nothing to do with Mexico. It's a dream world where people live in a fantasy land and think they went to Mexico. I'm sorry, you didn't go to Mexico. You may as well gone to Disney World and got your Mexican experience. Anyway, to criticize Einstein from his comments in his diary, which he wrote to himself, he didn't publish them, he didn't put them in the New York Times, he He didn't put it on YouTube or Twitter, which he didn't have, of course, but he didn't put it in public. He wrote it to his own notes and to himself. And so does this indicate that he is a racist? Excuse me. No. And it's very true. You go to some places, and I'll give you an example. When I used to travel, let's say, down in the coastline in the coastal regions down in the Caribbean and Mexico in the 1970s, you would come into a little town. Everything was beautiful, pink and little pastel blue paint on the houses, flowers in front of the houses, the roofs neatly trimmed, the thatched hut roofs, the palm trees groomed, vendors, people walking up and down the street very nicely dressed, the kids all nicely dressed, running around and playing, the dogs the dogs that you see on the street, well-fed, well-groomed. You come to the next town, and it looked like a nuclear bomb hit. And you go, my goodness, these towns are 20 miles apart. What's the difference? What is the difference? You know, they have the same economy, the same local. They sell the same things. You know, the kids are running around with no pants on. Everything is disheveled. The houses are leaning over. The dogs look like they are on death's row. What is the difference in these two towns? You know, it's not racism. It's observation. It's an observation. That's all. And so, you know, am I racist against people living in the Chiapas region of Mexico? No, I'm making an observation. That's what it is. It is a true observation. What if Einstein came into these places and he said, everything is so clean here. The people are so industrious and hardworking. Excuse me, that's not what he saw. That's not what was there. He's just making an observation, and as a scientist, making an observation is not being xenophobic nor racist. So anyway, political correctness is dead. And unfortunately, you know, we have to deal with these things. And by the way, I've created a three-letter, it's a new psychological disturbance. It's a psychological malady. And I call it DLS. DLS, I announced this on the Power Hour yesterday when I was on with Daniel Brigman. I said DLS, it's called Democrat Loss Syndrome. And what it amounts to is it's a psychological trauma syndrome of people who cannot get over that the Democrats did not win the election. And I want to include here that Trump is beating all expectations. Now, I never was political before. I'm really not political now, and I'm not Republican nor Democrat. But Trump is making history by this meeting in Korea, and I've read all of the negative press, and oh, it's only the first step, and Kim won big time, and just garbage. This was a monumental, make no mistake, this was an absolute monumental step for the human race to cure that problem in that part of the world. And I don't think a lot of people saw in the news the story. I'll repeat this because it's very important. Dennis Rodman is a basketball player, and he went over to North Korea to see what was going on, and he actually got so he met with Kim, 34-year-old leader of North Korea, who is the third generation now since the Korean War, which was, by the way, not a fun event for the North Koreans. It left them in absolute shambles. It is said that there were more bombs dropped on North Korea in the Korean War than in all of the time of World War II in the bombing of Europe. So anyway, this was a wonderful military-industrial complex moneymaker after World War II, because they realized that when World War II ended, hey, the money gig was up, And so anyway, they went in and created the Korean War because those Koreans were such a threat to our democracy that they started the Korean War over nothing, which we know is nothing, and in fact devastated that country, bombed the living crap out of it. And so the end result is, decades of living beaten into a corner. So anyway, Dennis Rodman goes over there, and of course, all the negative press in the United States against Kim. And Dennis Rodman actually gets to meet with Kim, and he finds out that Kim is going to have his birthday. So he wants to give him a present. She says, "What do you want for a birthday present? I want to get you a birthday present." Kim goes, "I want to see a basketball game." And Dennis Rodman goes, "Holy crap, what am I going to do here?" So he says, "Okay, I will get it together. We'll have a basketball game." So Rodman comes back to the U.S., organizes a bunch of his buddies from the basketball world and says, "Hey, let's go over and play basketball for this North Korea guy." And so, of course, there's no travel to North Korea. They get everything fixed so they can go over there. And on Kim's birthday, they play a basketball game. Basically a bunch of basketball guys, from the basketball world go over there, play a basketball game. And Kim comes up to him and he's doing selfies with his cell phone and he's really happy. And he says to Dennis Rodman, he says, "You are the first person that has kept his promise to me from your country." And it's like, oh my goodness, this is the viewpoint of those people. And I've lived in enough third world countries to know that you have to look at those people's attitudes from their eyes. And if you can't, don't sit around an armchair in your beautiful, nice house in the United States and think that you know how to judge people, because you don't, I guarantee you. I've often said, what do you do with high school students? As soon as they get out of high school, you give them a one-way ticket to a third world country, and they got to earn their money to get back. They don't have anything. They have to live amongst the people on the street, and that's what I did. And, I realized I lived with the rich people. I lived with the very poorest people. I lived with the middle class people, if there was a middle class, if you could even call it that. And I learned the culture. And believe me, it opened my eyes. That world out there is different. So you Americans sitting there that think you know everything because you read it in a newspaper, excuse me, you don't know Jack, buddy, or senora, whatever. You don't know anything about life in another country. So everybody wants to criticize Fidel Castro or Venezuela or other countries or Kim in North Korea. Until you see the world from their eyes, you better keep your mouth shut, because you don't know what you're talking about, I guarantee you. But anyway, that led the way for Trump to go over there and do the negotiations. And you could see that Kim wanted to negotiate. He wanted to sit down, and they signed an agreement that nobody thought would be signed maybe ever, to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula and bring in an economy, etc., so that North Korea could join the rest of the world. This is monumental. So when I see people being negative, I just cannot stand it. This is part of the DLS syndrome. Anyway, okay, enough of that. But these are monumental times. And I want to mention something else too. Because of my wing generator project, because of everything else I am doing personally, I deal with people from China, from India, from other countries, from Japan, from the United States, some from Europe. And what I'm seeing myself, this is my own observation, because I talk and deal with many people, and some of them are in factories and industry and in the steel industry and everything else. And what I'm seeing is that this did not exist a year ago, by the way, or a year and a half ago, but everybody, the businesses are booming everywhere. And that is because the United States has jumped out, and I'm doing international business that I wouldn't have done a year ago. And what I'm seeing is that everybody is, while some of the suppliers have mandatory overtime because they can't fill all the orders that they have. That's what's going on. This is incredible. And this is how something should be managed. So all of the DLS, the DLS syndrome people out there, you know, I don't have time for that anymore. The world is moving forward in a positive forward direction. And that's where I want to be. That's where I want to spend my time. I want to spend my time around positive people that are doing positive things, not people that are trying to drag us back into the past. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. Okay. Just a quick comment on the USS Liberty. This is during the 1967 the Israeli war against the Arabs. They came across, and this is well documented now, I suggest you go look this up, that the Israelis actually tried to sink that ship. It was Johnson and McNamara was the Department of Defense, which called off any support for that ship, American ship, communication ship that was over in the Gulf region. And they tried to sink that ship. 53 American sailors died, 170-some wounded, and they were calling and calling for help, and they knew it was the Israelis that were bombing their ship, trying to sink it, and that ship did not sink. So anyway, we now know the full story. Just a commentary. This is history. This is real history, not the history that you see in the fake history books in school. Okay, so right now I'm going to be talking about this alleged discovery of life on Mars that NASA made an announcement. And this is important because when I talk about these things, I leverage off of this to tell you what really is going on Mars. And so I posted some material on my webpage, jmccsci.com. I've got some pictures there dealing with the Martian surface. And I'm kind of playing off that old country western song. Remember, it was called Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. Well, my twist on that for NASA is looking for life in all the wrong places. And so while NASA is looking through a spectrometer at gas molecules coming off of heating up materials that they've dug out of the Martian surface, while they're looking at that, they're sitting, the rover, is sitting in a lake bed that could not be more than 5,000 years old, at the point where water actually left it. And so let me just explain what the announcement was, but germane to this entire discussion is that Mars right now, in this very moment, is involved in, or is basically being obscured by a global dust storm of huge proportions. The winds kick up, and this happens about once every Martian year, where the dust storms blow up, and they say that there is 0.002% visibility on Mars where the rover is. But this brings another side issue up. How does the rover clean itself? Do they have a car wash up there? And this is one of the mysteries, and I'll just say it. It's something I can't answer. The magic, once again, one of the magical things at NASA is this thing is being covered by probably a half an inch of dust, in, you know, that's blowing around the planet. And every now and then it seems that the rover gets, you know, what appears to be a complete car wash, squeaky clean look to it. And the dust is not just right now, it's blowing around Mars all the time. There are dust storms, there are basically dust devils, you could call them, electrical discharges between the Martian surface and the ionosphere. And these cause dust devils that race across the Martian surface, stirring up a lot of dust. And all that dust has to eventually fall back down to the planet. So Mars is a dusty, dusty place, much more so than the moon, because the moon does not have an atmosphere. Mars has dust flying all over. So the question is, how do these little rover guys clean themselves? And so I'm suspecting there's a car wash up there someplace. They landed near a car wash. It's a coin operated, so they can just drop a few quarters in, get cleaned up, get back out on the road. So anyway, the point is that Mars has surface features, riverbeds, many, many, many riverbeds. In fact, do this as an exercise. I posted some on my webpage, but just look up this, do a Google search, riverbeds on Mars, or and pull that up, and then say PICS, P-I-C-S. So if you want to look on, do a search, do a search on whatever you're looking for, and then put on the word at the end of your search, P-I-C-S, a separate word. And what that'll do is that'll bring up all the pictures on the internet relative to your question. And so I would type in riverbeds on Mars, PICS, P-I-C-S. And so up comes pages and pages of pictures of Mars that have been taken by U.S. NASA space probes over the years, going way back to the early ones, the early Mars orbiters, etc., and pictures of the surface of Mars with all of the pictures that show rivers on Mars. But of course, there's no water in them. They're dry. But the point is that NASA is trying to tell you the very first line in any of these announcements that they talk about discovery of life is that this was billions of years ago. Now, wait a minute. Where does the billions of years ago come from? I know Carl Sagan has passed and NASA has picked up on the billions and billions, but where exactly does this 3 billion years ago number come from? If you look at a molecule, okay, you got a molecule, you look at it, with your spectrometer, you can tell what it is. The radiation coming off of it tells you the spectral lines, and you can classify that as a small molecule. Where's the part? In my education, my vast experience in being in chemistry and physics and mathematics for all of my life, I missed the part where you look at a molecule, get its spectrum, and it tells you that that molecule is 3 billion years old. I missed that part. Please, please, somebody call up the head of NASA and ask him to go to his top scientists there and explain the amazing NASA technique for looking at a molecule and telling me that it's 3 billion years old molecule. Excuse me. That is, get your hip boots on, get the shoulder strap hip boots on, because it's getting real deep out here. So that's the first line of complete baloney. They have no idea that this is 3 billion years old. In fact, as I said, the rover is situated in a lake bed, which would not be there if it were 3 billion years ago when the water was there creating the lake bed. Why? Because the dust storms erode everything away over time. And in a 10,000-year period, none of those riverbeds would be there. In a 50,000-year period, guaranteed, you wouldn't see a trace of any of these. They would be covered up, worn away. Sandblasting is one of the most effective ways of cutting steel, polishing steel, or any other metals. If you take a sandblaster, and that's what's going on Mars, it's literally a sandblaster. They have winds up to 300 to 400 miles an hour there with the blowing the dust around. So you're telling me that this pristine riverbed that has all the little angles and all the little features is 3 billion years old? Excuse me, and it's withstood 3 billion years of sand blasting, NASA? No, this is not possible. These features on Mars are no more than a few thousand years old that the water has been missing. You find deltas of rivers. Now, what's a delta of a river? Like the Mississippi or the Nile has a delta. And what happens is the sediment comes down, and the water still has to make its way through, but the sediment builds up and creates little islands down there. One of my favorite things when I was going to Tulane down in New Orleans was to get in my little car on the weekend and go down into the bayous, which was right down there with the by the Delta, the Mississippi Delta. And the Cajuns lived down there. And you'd get down there on a Friday night, the shrimp boats would be coming in, they'd be dumping the fresh shrimp out and potatoes and corn and jambalaya is what they were making, these big pots of food, and the music was playing and the people were happy and the men were, you know, lifting the shrimp and the women were cleaning it and throwing it in the pot, and it was a wonderful, probably one of the most wonderful scenes I've seen in my life. I've seen a lot. But I used to go down there, and that's the Mississippi Delta area. Of course, now all destroyed because of Hurricane Katrina. But anyway, that's another story. But the Mississippi River Delta, the Nile Delta, these are built-up islands, basically, because the sediment comes down, builds up, and then makes this series of islands out in the form of a delta. Okay, so at any rate, you see these deltas on Mars. You see the river coming down, you see the delta, and then it spills into the ocean. What else do you see on Mars? You see craters on the highlands. The highlands are very well developed on Mars. There's a region of Mars which is highlands, and there's a region of Mars which is lowlands. It's a lot like Earth in that if you take the globe of the Earth and you turn it around so you're looking kind of at the south of the Indian Ocean. You just keep moving the globe around, and what you'll see is that about from a certain perspective looking from that side of the Earth, it's pretty much all water. Those are the lowlands of Earth. Those are the parts covered with water. If you turn it around 180 degrees, all of the land of Earth pretty much is on the other half of Earth. So it's kind of an egg shape. It's not really a globe. It's not a perfect spherical globe. And Mars is much the same, although Mars does not have the water now. Where did it go? The water went when the comet Venus came by, as Velikovsky points out, and ripped it off, and every ancient culture has seen this. And they write about it, that Mars was a blue planet within historic times. It lost its oceans and atmosphere to a large passing comet, which was Venus, the comet. The comet which eventually became the planet Venus. The Mayans talk about it, the Incas, the Aztecs in their history, the Chinese, the Indian, the ancient Indian texts, and the Mideastern texts, all of these talk about these events with Mars being a blue planet. And that's Velikovsky was the master of all of this, where he pointed out this very important event in celestial history. And so this is what I say. NASA is looking for life in all the wrong places. Now, here's the other problem with what they've done. And so let me just cap off what I'm saying. Here they are sitting in a lake bed that is no more than 5,000 years old. It's all around them. They're sitting in it. It's like the elephant in the room. And they're pulling up little molecules and looking at them and saying, oh, the molecule is a 3 billion-year-old molecule. Excuse me. I mean, this is retarded. They pre-planned this announcement. They always do this. So they get blanket coverage over the weekend. So it was Thursday when they had the announcement. They would not allow Science, which was the rubber stamp, so-called peer-reviewed journal this garbage is published in. Science is the rubber stamp journal of NASA, or Nature, also in England, is the equivalent in the UK of Science in the United States. These are rubber stamp agencies. If NASA publishes something, I guarantee you, they say this was peer-reviewed. Excuse me, it was not peer-reviewed. And they never asked me to peer-review it, I guarantee you that. These are, yes, NASA said it, published it, put it in there, but they told Science, where this garbage was published, not to say anything. They were under an embargo. A news embargo is when the news media is given pre-access to a story, but there's a time on it, a timestamp. So the Science could not release that story until NASA released it itself. NASA wanted all the publicity, and they got it. USA Today, I mean, you look at any publication out there, online or otherwise, and they are carrying this story, and the headlines are so deceptive. NASA discovers life on Mars. What a crock. I mean, and okay, so let's talk about the molecules that they so-called discovered. These are molecules that are typically classified as organic. Now, what's organic? If you look at chemistry, there's actually a pretty fine line, and as with anything, there's some gray area. Is this molecule organic or is it inorganic? Well, organic seems to indicate it leans toward the side of biological life. In other words, they're more complex molecules. By the way, I talk about this in my discussion when I talked about Carl Sagan and criticizing his Cosmos series and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and they talk about evolution. And I bring up the question, where does intelligence come from in evolution? How does this molecule gain intelligence when you put enough of them together to make a human body? Where is the physical chemistry formula in the science that supposedly explains all this? Because if it's scientifically true, don't you think they probably should have answered most of the scientific questions regarding this idea? Well, you would think so, but they haven't. They have not. And one of the questions is, where does the life come from in organic molecules? Good grief. That's a legitimate question, and they can't answer it. Why can't they answer it? Because they don't know. They don't have an answer. The whole idea of evolution is on very thin ice. It's a series of speculations that seem probable, but there's no proof for it. There's no scientific proof. And what would you need for scientific proof? You would need somebody there when this evolution was occurring, taking objective data at the time. Excuse me, but I don't know anybody that has that data. This is speculative science at its best. Seems like it could be a good story. Maybe. Just like plate tectonics, seems like it's a pretty good story, except where's the forces that move entire continents around the globe laterally? Where is that force, Carl Sagan and the boys and, Stephen Jay Gould or geologists who worked with Sagan? Explain to me the force that moves an entire continent laterally around the surface of the Earth. They can't. They don't have an answer. So, but it's taught in every textbook, all the way up to PhD levels. You know, plate tectonics, evolution, as if they're somehow facts. They weave a good story. You get a nice drawing in a textbook with the plates subducting under one under the other. They repeat it enough times. Must be true. Wow, this is science. But anyway, getting back to these molecules that they so-called discovered, they're allegedly organic molecules. That includes carbons, oxygens, hydrogen, nitrogen, and phosphorus. But the problem is these molecules contain sulfur. Now, one of the things that you use literally in determining the organic nature of molecules is that they don't have sulfur. In fact, this is how you tell DNA from proteins that look just like DNA but are not DNA. The DNA and the RNA don't have sulfur. That's how you tell them apart from the proteins that look just like the DNA. If they have sulfur, then they're not DNA. That's how you tell them apart. So somebody maybe tapped these geological bio engineers over at NASA on the shoulder and say, look, you know, the fact that they have sulfur atoms mixed into these molecules tells you that they are not organic. And so anyway, they're trying to stretch it and say, well, they're organic molecules, but they contain a sulfur atom. Well, where did the sulfur come from? Sulfur is not a free molecule in outer space. Outer space, sulfur occurs as sulfur dioxide. It forms very readily with oxygen, just like water. If you get hydrogen, is one of the biggest free elements in space, but if you look for oxygen, you typically find oxygen connected to something else. Water is a great example. H2O. That O is connected to the hydrogen, and if they get any place close to each other in outer space, they're going to combine. That hydrogen atom, H2, is going to combine with that oxygen. And the same thing with sulfur. In the case of sulfur, it combines with two oxygens, and you get sulfur dioxide. That's the common form of sulfur in outer space. So where do you get single atomic sulfur from? The answer is volcanoes. Volcanoes. Let me repeat that for all the NASA scientists who listen to this in their back room at night, you know, not telling anybody else they're listening to it because they would be embarrassed and, of course, to think that they're getting publishable material out of my radio show. The question is, where do the sulfur atoms come from in these alleged organic molecules? And it comes from volcanoes because the sulfur is in the volcanic explosions. It's coming from deeper within the planet, just like on Earth. And in the heated environment, that's where these molecules formed. And the big surprise that you would find it in rocks in a riverbed. The other thing I was saying about the highlands and lowlands of Mars is you see the cratering all around on the highlands, and you don't see any on the lowlands. What does that tell you? That the craters were destroyed by the action of water. And so you don't see craters on the lowlands. You don't see them in the lower regions, the lower altitude regions of the Martian surface. So at any rate, this was a major bogus announcement by NASA. It is unfortunate that I believe they're just looking for funding for future rover missions. That's the impression I get. But it really is sick the way they put these scientists up in front of the camera. It's really disgusting. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. Remember to visit my webpage, jmccsci.com. The water filters are still on sale, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.